Okay, so I'm joined today by Joe Fox, a professor and historian at the University of London. Joe's research specializes in the history of propaganda, rumor, and mis and disinformation. Joe, thank you so much for your time and for speaking today.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you.
So yeah, I've just mentioned some of your research specialties. It'd be great to hear if that was kind of roughly what you've kind of get up to in your work, and maybe you can give us a bit more of a detailed overview of your kind of research throughout your career.
Yeah, I've always been interested in propaganda and mis and disinformation. Of course, it came really to the fore in 2016 with Trump and with Brexit, but of course it's been a force throughout history. And I started researching propaganda way back in my PhD thesis, which looked at the role and image of women in feature films in the Third Reich. And it really just grew from there. It's such a fascinating phenomenon, really. And now it's come to dominate a lot of political and public discourse. It's really at the forefront of discussions over democracy, what kind of society we want to be, and increasingly the impacts of technology and AI on society. So while I'm a historian, my research now tends to focus on today. And I think that's it's not an unusual position for historians to be in, because so much of our work is relevant to policy today. But this one feels quite pressing, quite urgent, and quite present.
Yeah, so let's look at a couple of these different terms in case someone isn't sure exactly what they mean. So mis and disinformation. Firstly, what's the difference between those two?
Disinformation is the deliberate act. That is an act that is deliberately designed as an act of psychological warfare to destabilize the media environment, the infosphere. Misinformation is false information that we might pass on inadvertently. So we can all be guilty, I think, of passing on false rumour, false information, you know, for various reasons. And we might explore some of that, why people do that. But disinformation is really a deliberate act, often by state actors, but not necessarily. So can be political groupings, can be pressure groupings. But that is an act of deliberate deception.
And you said, yeah, since 2016, there's been like a significant rise in it around the world.
It's always been there. It's just been much more present because of debates over, you know, Trump, the election, Russian interference, Brexit, the extent to which truthful information was given throughout those campaigns. And with the advent of social media really has changed the landscape. Not necessarily in terms of the content, how propaganda, mis and disinformation works, but the scale, scope and speed of the way that that information travels. So I think it's become, you know, much more live. And of course, we saw it during the COVID pandemic around debates over vaccinations.
And what these other terms as well. So propaganda, how do you understand what propaganda is exactly?
That is the ultimate question, isn't it? I never define propaganda. And the reason being is that there was an excellent scholar of propaganda called Leonard Dube. And right at the end of his career, a career that he had actually spent trying to define propaganda, he said a definition of propaganda is neither possible nor desirable. And I stick to that because it can be such a catch-all. If you start to define it, it almost immediately slips out of your hands. And it distracts us, I think, from the key question, which is how does propaganda work? That's what we really need to know rather than what it is.
This reminds me of I study philosophy. Often people say define philosophy is actually quite tricky, philosophical, I suppose, in itself to define it. So maybe to help us understand a bit what propaganda is, you can maybe explain why it's hard to define propaganda. Like, why is it a slippery concept, do you think?
Yeah. Because it can capture so many things. It can be an act of political persuasion, or it can be what I've just described. It can be an act of deliberate, active psychological warfare. It can be little nudges and little tweaks, or it can be a full-on deception campaign. It fits that whole range of activities, including things that are not necessarily negative. You know, propaganda, you can have public health campaigns that could easily be defined as an act of propaganda, a means of persuading you to behave in certain ways. It's not necessarily a negative concept. It came to feel like that over the course of the 20th century. But as a concept itself, it can be such a catch-all term. And to put it in boxes means that you don't necessarily get closer to understanding what it is or how it works.
And this other term, like rumour. So, I mean, I guess everyone have an intuition what that means, but what does that mean exactly when you were deeply researching it?
Yeah, this is, you know, this is a form. It can cross mis and disinformation. It's been used in both. But it's information that we pass on in interesting ways, quite often to sense check. We're trying to make sense of the world around us. Have you heard about this? Did you hear that? It's a way of reassuring ourselves. It's dealing with our innermost fears, hopes, desires. And it's very prevalent in circumstances that are uncertain at moments of crisis. We're all trying to make sense of the world around us. And we use rumour as a means of doing that. It can have very negative consequences because inadvertently, or maybe deliberately, you're trying to circulate a sense of uncertainty. So, and in some cases also disinformation. So rumour is a way that humans sense check the world around them and can express deep-seated fears, anxieties, hopes, beliefs. In at a remove, have you heard that, takes it away from us and puts a distance, but allows us nonetheless to sense check the information we think that's troubling us.
I mean, you talked about like things going on today. A lot of your research though has been on World War II propaganda. So propaganda used by Germany, Britain and other nations. Can you tell us about some of the key kind of areas of propaganda in World War II that you've looked into?
Yeah, lots. Actually, it's, and at First World War II, it becomes ubiquitous in the modern era, and it becomes all-consuming in some senses because of the mass media. The evolution of the mass media in the 20th century means that propagandists had so much more at their disposal and being able to reach the masses in ways that were not possible before. Media, and it's the types of media, the modern media, film, radio, print, mass print media, alongside more traditional forms of propaganda, like oral propaganda, word of mouth. That was also used throughout both the First and Second World Wars, you know, particularly where personal connections matter. Soviet Union had an immense form of oral propaganda going on during the First and Second World Wars. So it is a huge range of media that propaganda starts being disseminated through. So for the historian, it's a treasure trove of archival material. The more difficult question is working out the effect it had. I think that's tricky for anyone to say with any real certainty the impact of either the cumulative effect of that propaganda or even individual pieces of propaganda at any one time.
As you say, it's difficult to do, but how do you attempt to go about measuring the impact of propaganda?
You can look at, there are sources that sought to trace the effects of propaganda during the Second World War. In Britain, we had mass observation, which was a mass anthropology experiment, really, and it left behind this extraordinary archive of how people saw the world around them during the Second World War. And they reported how they felt after seeing a particular film or listening to a radio broadcast or a Churchill speech by Churchill. So it allows us to have a sense of what people felt at the time, its contemporary view. So that's really important. There are other more innovative ways too. In the United States, they set up rumor clinics all over, particularly in places where you're more likely to share gossip, so in a pub, in the barber. But it was a safe way of communicating rumours you heard, and they were all collected together. So we have a sense of what rumours were circulating and how, you know, if they stick in the mind, someone's bound to pass them on. It's telling you something about impact. All of those are now kept in the Library of Congress. So we're able to piece together somewhat fragmentary sources. They get a sense of the impact. But, and this is really important, those sources only tell us what people were able to say publicly about how they were feeling. there will have been a lot of people who held some of the fears, particularly in wartime, that you don't want to be seen as defeatist, very close to their hearts. So sometimes private diaries, memoirs can help you unravel. But that only tells you individual private opinions. You never really get a full sense of the impact of something through those sources. So we do a bit of a piecing together exercise to get a feel for how people were being perhaps affected by some of the propaganda that surrounded them.
Yeah, Joe, you wrote this book, which maybe you mentioned earlier, called Film Propaganda in Britain and Nazi Germany, World War II Cinema. Was this book kind of about, like, was the use of cinema as a means for promoting propaganda a bit of a revolution, like, in terms of propaganda that hadn't really been utilised before World War II?
No, it had. It had certainly been used in the First World War. You know, some of the most powerful cinematic propaganda came out in the First World War, the Battle of the Somme, 1916. This is one of the first times that audiences were watching. They felt as if they were watching real action from the front. I mean, the profound effect that that must have had on audiences. It's extraordinary. By the time Second World War comes along, you've got a diversified film environment. So you've got regular newsreels, you've got propaganda, full-on propaganda films, you've got shorts, and you've got feature films, escapist feature films, including, in the first time, in colour. And of course, you've got the advent of sound in the interwar period. So the immersive effect of cinema is much greater, and propagandists really use that to the max. For me, the interesting thing was, are there trends here? What is the comparative context between a totalitarian state, such as Nazi Germany, and a democratic state? Are they using the same kind of devices, themes, tropes? My interest was not necessarily in cinema as an artistic form, but cinema as a means of understanding how propaganda works.
Yeah, so when you did that kind of comparative analysis, you said similar ideas, themes, and tropes. But so, yeah, what can you dig more into that? So what was similar? What was different between Germany and England?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of similarities, they're the things that you would expect to see in any kind of propaganda campaign around war. You expect to see films about why the war is happening, justifying war, justifying the different positions. And of course, that's exactly what you get. You also see depictions of the home front. You see films about leadership and historical parallels and analogies and escapism. Now, for Britain, and indeed for, you know, the Allied nations, they had that enormous pull of Hollywood as well, with all of its star power. Germany just didn't have that in the same way. They had their stars, but they weren't global stars in the way that you see Charlie Chaplin or Vivian Leigh, Leslie Howard, all became very visibly connected to propaganda. Walt Disney. I mean, the power of those particular global stars and brands to be able to carry the propaganda out, and often in ways that are much more, they're biting because the humour was just that bit sharper.
Yeah, and as well as cinema, I've seen you talk about, like, the role of women in propaganda, like the use of women to maybe motivate troops to go abroad and fight and come back to them, you know, their loved ones at home. Can you give us some examples of how women were utilised in this way?
The most profound examples I've ever seen of that are in relation to the First World War. And a few years ago, I had a wonderful opportunity to look through some of the collections at the British Library, some of the postcard collections, postcards that were sent to troops at the front, with some of the most motivating images that you can imagine, and drawing on really core human emotions. So there were postcards saying, you know, fight for your sweetheart, and a picture of a young woman on, you know, that really, if you're going to be at the front fighting for your country, what are you actually fighting for? One of the key motivators are your sweetheart, your mum, your sister, your children. And propagandists used that kind of idea to motivate or to keep the focus on for the fighting troops. Also, you know, there was the other side of that, which is, you know, if you don't yet have a sweetheart, who do you think the girls are going to want to marry when you come back from the front? Who do you think they're going to find attractive? The man who did his duty for the nation, or someone who didn't? So there were this kind of postcards that also looked at how being a soldier made you attractive to women. Not being a soldier, the opposite. So they were really drawing on very deep, primitive human feelings and instincts. And women were used in lots of ways in the First World War, but that's one of the ways in which propagandists could motivate the troops by pulling on those deep emotions.
Do you have any much of an opinion yourself on the propaganda that Britain used to do things such as this, motivate people to go to war, or other things and so on, that you think were maybe less ethical means of propaganda?
Well, it depends on the end point, doesn't it? Let's take an example from the Second World War. Britain, as well as the propaganda that was more truthful in nature, often pushed through things like the Ministry of Information. We're now sitting in a building which was home to Britain's Ministry of Information. It had its home here in Senate House. And the BBC, you need channels where you are putting out propaganda that is based in truth, what you might call white propaganda. But the British also had a subversive unit called the Political Warfare Executive, not based here, but actually based out in Woburn, under the head Sefton Delmer. Now, they put out all kinds of things that we might consider to be unethical. Full on lies, deception. It was a deception unit. It was a psychological warfare unit. We might not consider that ethical as a practice in its own right, but do we consider it ethical to defeat Nazi Germany? You know, does the end justify the means? I think my view was, yes, it does. You know, the existential threat and the evil of the Nazi regime, you needed to use whatever tactics psychologically you could. What if Sefton Delmer's unit had actually managed to provoke a revolution in Germany? To overthrow the Nazi regime. It would have brought the war to an end and possibly saved millions of lives. Is that an ethical act? Using unethical means? That's full-on lying deception unit. So I think it's more complex than saying, okay, we won't use those practices when you're facing an enemy like Nazi Germany. And that was a debate that propagandists had in the Second World War. We're fighting Goebbels here. You know, we have there was a very famous cartoon by David Lowe where the picture showing the best cause in the world, the Allied cause, and the worst propaganda on one side, and on the other side, a picture of Goebbels. The best propaganda in the world and the worst cause. You know, do you just say, well, we want to be completely squeaky clean and ethical, and therefore we're not going to use their tactics? There was a big debate. And there were different camps. We're a democracy. We ought to be able to fight this using truth, because truth is powerful and truth will do it alone. But on the other side, you know, people saying we've got to fight fire with fire. We've got to get aggressive. We are facing a formidable enemy that has geared up for aggressive psychological warfare. Do you deploy then the same? I think they're very real dilemmas, and that, you know, propaganda and democracy don't always sit easily together, but there comes a point where you might want to think about how you deploy that kind of propaganda in order to protect democracy. Does it become ethical then?
Yeah, very interesting. If someone wants to, let's think about something though that is kind of unethical manipulation and propaganda, what should someone be aware of if they want to not fall for unethical propaganda? Obviously very hard to do if it's, you know, well delivered and stuff, but what are some things people could be aware of? Obviously very, don't depend on where they are in the world, but you know, what can people look out for?
So hard. Now, this is a very interesting point, because in 1937 in the United States, there was an organization set up exactly for this purpose called the Institute of Propaganda Analysis. And following what happened in the First World War and all of the debates in the post-war period about whether we ought to be using propaganda in democracies and the role that propaganda played. They set up this institute with a view to equipping populations to spot propaganda and to protect themselves against it. And in fact, they put forward a sort of 7 points that you should be on the alert for, and they put them onto a little card that you could put in your wallet, and that if you felt that you were being subjected to propaganda, you could whip out your 7 points and cross-check, you know, is this a glittering generality? Is this something that... Of course, that doesn't work, because propagandists are clever, usually, and they know how to manipulate your pre-existing beliefs and deep beliefs. The one thing I would say, and particularly now, in the era of social media, is be very sceptical of what you're seeing online. It's very hard sometimes. Sometimes it's obvious that this is, you know, an act of disinformation. But now it's getting increasingly hard with things like deep fakes and fake accounts. It's hard to work out the real identity of the person passing that information to you. And that is why I think it is so very important for us to have faith in and invest in those channels of investigative reporting, like the BBC, like the New York Times, that it's really important for us to have faith in those organisations. If you think about the BBC's role in the Second World War, people across Europe were tuning in to get that news because it was trusted, and because, and even in the threat of the death penalty in Germany, if you were caught listening to foreign radio, that had very serious consequences for you. People did it anyway, en masse. And, you know, it is so important to have those anchor sources of information and news. And if we're not careful, we could lose those anchor points. I think it's really important where we get our news media. So having trusted sources now matters. The other thing I would say is to check your pre-existing beliefs and think about how open you are to disinformation yourself. I know there are certain things where I'm more prone to believe something because it aligns with my either political belief system or my personal belief system. That leaves me really quite vulnerable to a propagandist who might seek to nudge me one way. If you think about the way that you consume information, particularly if you're scrolling, you consume it very quickly. You don't stop yourself. You don't stop and pause. Is that right? Should I check that? You know, using fact check, you know, the BBC have got a fantastic unit that fact checks things. I read those regularly just to, you know, part check my own balances and biases, because that is exactly where propaganda really gets in under your skin, is if it can tap into something that is held very dear to you, is a very dear pre-existing belief, and it can really work within that seam. In terms of the broader piece, I think we need a really good civic education program so that we are educating our young people about that media environment that they're confronting and what disinformation is, how it circulates. We need to tackle it early so that people grow up knowing it's there and thinking for themselves.
The bit you said about BBC fact checks is interesting because, yeah, connects us to something I wanted to ask earlier when we were talking about mis and disinformation. So, as I'm sure you know, I feel like a lot of people at the moment are unsure who to trust. And so they think, you know, this organization, for example, BBC, or this part of the government says, this is misinformation, this is disinformation, here are the facts. But how do we know we can trust them as well?
One of the really interesting phenomenons of today's media landscape is that those who seek to undermine our democracy through information campaigns want us not to trust anything. So there is, one of the tactics they use is to destabilize our entire media system and the trust that we place in it, because that is, ultimately they want you to feel confused. They want you not to know who to trust. They want to create an unstable environment. That's where they can work best, when we don't trust those sources like the BBC, with a long track record of delivering world-class news. They want you not to trust it, because the second those anchor points are gone, we are open to a whole range of misdisinformation, rumour. We've got no anchor point anymore. And I think that's an incredibly dangerous place to be. And when our own politicians put us in those places, I think that we ought to have a collective sense of responsibility, of being very clear that we need those anchor points, because otherwise we are really in danger of being much, much more vulnerable to intervention in our democratic system. So it's more important than ever to be able to trust media with that kind of track record.
With a great track record over time, how do we balance that with concerns of, organisations over time becoming corrupt or changing?
You have good governance, good scrutiny. And I think that's in place. We have an environment whereby we can scrutinise and hold those organisations to account. And we do. But we need to do that on the basis of evidence. And this is the next point, is really that it is so important to make sure that whatever allegations are thrown around about, about conduct or about accountability, that what those allegations ought to be evidenced. And we seem to drift now away from an evidence-based approach to judgment. And I think it's so important. And it began with that erosion of the notion of expertise. Expertise actually matters. And it matters when you go and see a doctor. And it should matter also in wider civic life. So I think trusting expertise, basing judgment on evidence and good governance, does back up our democratic state, and it makes it harder for disinformation to gain a foothold. At the moment, it's very difficult. We need to pull together and have a collective sense of responsibility, and that extends to our wider media environment, including social media.
So how do you think technology, perhaps kind of advanced artificial intelligence, these more sophisticated systems we're building, might worsen negative, unethical propaganda and help people deliver kind of more dangerous messages to people? Are you concerned much about technologies coming around in the next couple of decades?
I am, and particularly things like deep fakes, in all kinds of ways. AI is making it's very hard now to distinguish between, the fake and the real. And I think we've got to be really alert. But I'm also a techno-optimist, because I think that you can also deploy, there will be ways to deploy AI to detect those deep fakes and to protect our media environment. Just like propaganda, it's how we choose to deploy it that is going to matter, and whether we choose to deploy it ethically. But I think as AI gets smarter, I think it will be even more difficult for us to really know for sure what it is we're looking at. And that requires us to develop and continue to develop our human skills in critical thinking. And this really matters at a time when, some of the subjects that we study are being eroded that do exactly that. You said you studied philosophy. It's really important to study these disciplines, because they develop, above all, the ability to think critically. And we are going to need that. And we are going to need a sense of what it means to be human in an age of AI, and the ethics about how we deploy any new technologies. And that's why I think that some of the subjects we study, literatures, cultures, languages, philosophy, history, they all bring with them that ability to think critically. It's going to be the most important skill we have.
So it'd be good to ask you a little bit more about this kind of stuff in the kind of connection to you and yourself. So the research that you do into all these areas that we've talked about so far, yeah, why do you find them personally so interesting? Why are you so motivated to work on them?
History is just fascinating to me, and it always has been. And it, as with so many of our stories, they start with a brilliant teacher. Mine was called Mr. McLean, and he made history just so exciting. He left every lesson on a cliffhanger. You had to go and find out what the next chapter of this was. You can wait till the next, to the next lesson. And I wanted to know, how are we here? How do we arrive historically at this moment in time? What's different about the times I live in to things that happened in the past? But for me, that unlocked it, what was the most amazing teaching. And I think teaching is the most remarkable profession that has such an ability to change people's lives. It did mine. You know, I came from a comprehensive school in Essex, an East End comp, and the opportunities that education has unlocked for me have been extraordinary. I've had an extraordinary life, all thanks to wonderful, inspirational teaching. It matters.
How has developing like a deep expertise and understanding of the kind of things we've talked about, the kind of propaganda, disinformation and stuff, both past and present, changed? How has this understanding changed you as a person? How does it change how you interface with the world, live your daily life, and treat about this impact on yourself?
It should impact me more, but I'm just as susceptible to propaganda as the next person. And, you know, I think having an awareness of that, it certainly doesn't make you immune to it. Absolutely not. What it has done for me is make me very alert to the importance of information and the importance of sharing fact-based, evidence-based information, particularly, and this really does matter to me, and it's why I got into studying Nazi Germany. I am frightened for democracy, and that's what fascinated me about Nazi Germany. How did it come to pass that a country that had the most liberal democratic system under the Weimar democracy, within a very short period of time, found itself in dictatorship? And to me, I found, when I was reading that as a teenager, I found that terrifying. I still find it terrifying. And so I think how it affects the way that I see the world now is wanting to be a staunch defender of democracy. It matters to all of us. And we have to fight, as many did throughout the 20th century, really fight to protect it, to defend it. Once it's gone, it's gone.
Do you have any idea where this came from, this real fear at a young age of democracy being lost?
It was just reading. It was reading history books and thinking, how? I don't understand how that can happen. But also, I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up, in the 80s. My political memory starts in the 80s. And there was a real fear of this ideological warfare that was going on between East and West. It was really tangible and palpable. We read things in school like When the Wind Blows, the Raymond Briggs cartoon book, which shows an old couple who are living through the aftermath of a nuclear attack. The old couple who looked like your nan and granddad. I mean, this was something that was real or felt real. And, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Two Tribes. This was something that was palpable. And the very powerful film or TV program Threads, I remember being told by my parents not to come downstairs and watch it. I watched it and I regretted it immediately. So that sense of sort of ideological war going on throughout the Cold War period, but for me very tangibly in the 19 1980s. It's all part of a kind of political mindset that you grow up around.
And when you were younger and completed your PhD in history, I'm intrigued, what was your research on them? Was it in similar areas?
Yeah. No, it was on, my PhD was on women in film in the Third Reich, but motivated really by the need to understand that fundamental question. Why do people turn, why does a country turn to totalitarianism? What are the drivers? How does a country find itself, you know, in a position where the end point of this is World War and the Holocaust? How? What are the steps by which that happens? It's very hard, I think, to understand. And it's terrifying, the levels at which, you know, the complicity, terror, propaganda, they all work together to end up at this space. And it's incredibly complex. But I was interested in what were the steps, what led to that. And partly because I don't ever want to find myself in a state that is going along that road.
I mean, especially if it's not about your particular research interest, history broadly, history more generally. If someone is a bit ignorant of history, doesn't know much about it, what would you say are good reasons for someone to develop a deeper understanding of the world and history? Why is this beneficial for someone's character?
There are so many reasons. I think fundamentally, it helps you to understand human behaviour throughout, not just in your own moment, but that you exist in a longer continuum. And to understand how things arrive at where they are now, what are the historical determinants and contingencies of why we are now? Why do we have a monarchy? And, you know, anything around you has got this extraordinary history. Why do we have, you know, the cultures and beliefs and that we have in Britain? You know, what it also helps you understand, you know, diversity. You know, I love the way that history is now diversifying some of the work around being black and British by David Olushoga. And so it's just transforming our way of what we understand about who we are now and where we might want to go. Because we've also got plenty of examples from history of places, like I've just described, that we may not want to go, and exemplars of where we might want to go. But it is a rich tapestry of human existence that helps to position and understand that the world's a bit more than about us.
Yeah, and as I mentioned to you before we started filming, I'm kind of involved in this AI safety space. Do you think it's really important for people at the forefront of AI, you know, working on the future, to understand the past?
I think so, because, you know, when one of the things that I find really fascinating about the period that I study is that new technologies always provoke some kind of social anxieties, fears. Whenever a new technology comes along, it always comes hand in hand with some sort of existential questioning of where we are. AI is no different. We're just thinking about how we're going to handle that. That was true of the media technologies of the 1920s, when radio comes along, when television comes along, it always accompanied by a whole series of moral panics or social anxieties or fears, or maybe technological over-optimism, what it can and can't do. So I think understanding how humans react to technology and how they handle it, how they incorporate it, where it's gone wrong in the past, is there things that we can learn from a policy perspective? I think, you know, some of the government departments are very connected into understanding where policy has gone wrong in the past, so they don't go ahead and repeat the exact same mistakes over and over. History can help inform smart policymaking. And in fact, we've got a in the School of Advanced Study, which is a national centre for the arts and humanities, we've got a history and policy unit here dedicated to exactly that. So why repeat over and over and over again mistakes that people have made before you? Better to learn from the past if you can, to stop that happening.
It'd be great for you to maybe explain, you touched on it briefly earlier, where we are exactly. So we're in your office at the University of London, yeah, in Senate House. And I believe this building, the big tall building outside, the big round building, was Orwell's source of inspiration for the Ministry of Truth.
So they say.
Okay.
So they say his wife, wife Eileen worked here. She worked in the Ministry of Information. So it wouldn't be a huge, you know, stretch of the imagination. It certainly looks Orwellian, doesn't it? And I think, you know, this is a wonderful building built by Charles Holden as a kind of monument, I think, to knowledge. This was meant to be and is now London's knowledge quarter. An open place for learning, and it still is. That big tower is actually a library, and we're just embarking on a huge library transformation program here that brings back Holden's vision of having a knowledge quarter open to all in London. But during the Second World War, of course, it is requisitioned and becomes the home of the Ministry of Information, which was Britain's propaganda agency throughout the Second World War. So it's from this building that a lot of that propaganda content that we've been talking about today originated. And I find it extraordinary sometimes to be sitting in here reading about propaganda, writing, thinking about propaganda in a place, even in this room, you know, where that activity took place. You know, the big halls downstairs, they were the big Ministry of Information press briefing rooms. They look very different now. But if you were here in 1942, it would have been full of switchboards and news media and reporters waiting to hear from the Minister of Information, Brendan Bracken, about what the lines were going to be for the day. So this place would have been alive with propagandists, people running lines to defeat Nazi Germany. So, you know, it's a really remarkable place to be given the great privilege of thinking about the role of propaganda in protecting democracy in a place that was dedicated to just that during the Second World War.
So it can't be a coincidence then. Is the departmental work already on this here when you joined? I mean, how are you here doing this?
It's complete coincidence. I came here as the first female director of the Institute of Historical Research, which has been here for 100 years, helping researchers, no matter what subject of history they study. It's a national centre for history and historians. So I came here just by coincidence, but it was an interesting one for me, given what my research focuses on.
Okay, and as a final question, Joe, so I actually ask every guest the same question at the end of the episode, which is, I'd be intrigued, yeah, your views based on your historical understanding of people and stuff. So yeah, the question is, what do you think it means to live a good life?
Ah, what it means to live a good life. That's a really difficult question, isn't it, in a way. I think it means to me, and it comes back to my deep, deep commitment to universities. Ever since I was little, apparently I came home from university, from school when I was about 8 and said to my mum, I'm going to a place called a university, and it's been in my life really and an ambition of mine ever since. So often we measure a university education through the economic value it brings to the individual, but it's more than that. It teaches us to think about the world around us and to be mindful of it. And I think that's actually what it means to live a good life, to experience love and companionship and thought, thinking about the world, not just existing in it, but thinking about the world around you. I think that would be my answer. Value of a life is not measured in economic gain. It's measured in what you can give back. And I think a university education equips you to be so much more than work ready. It equips you to be world ready. And I think being world ready is what we all need. And I think that's what it's going to mean to live a good life through the 21st century.
Thank you so much, Joe. This has been really interesting. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for everything.
Pleasure.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.